The regular and supplemental meetings are called to order. Like to recess the supplemental meeting and start off with a moment of silence for those that are not with us anymore. Thank you. We're going to move to the consent agenda. The first thing would be the approval of the minutes from both the required public meeting and the regular meeting from last May 11th. Any comments or questions? If not, can someone make a motion?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those are six ayes. Any opposed? Motion carries. The detailed consent agenda, Kelly, anything there you want to flag?
On page 15, which we won't look at here in the public meeting, there's a list of earnings tests. So once a year, we have to look at those people that are on a disability retirement and make sure they can exceed their earnings from outside employment, which would require us to reduce their pension. So we do that analysis. They're listed there. Nobody is required to take a reduction this year, so that's on there this time.
Okay. So can we have a motion to approve the detailed consent agenda? Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Sounds like six to me. Any opposed? Motion carries. Next, public comment in our gallery. Anything anyone would like to say?
No.
Okay. And John, anyone on the phone?
If anybody on the phone wants to speak, press 5-star.
Okay. Well, moving on, we have item C1. Kelly, you want to just frame the issue of the election? I know you all saw a lot of my election posters on the way in. And the brownies that my mom made.
So our statute specifically requires that the board elect the board chairman, vice chairman, deputy vice chairman in June of every odd numbered year, which is a little awkward given the fact that our trustees turn over, you know, 3 months later. But we're required to do the selection now. And then we can do it again in September, or really any time the board wants, you can do another election. So this is a requirement of the statute to appoint or reappoint those positions that are listed.
Okay. So just to clarify, Bill, your term is ending this year, and
yes,
your intention is to...
I'm required to go up
forward
by then.
Like General MacArthur, they just... old chairman don't die, they just fade away. For me, there's going to be sort of a consultation, I guess, with the mayor, because I think I was technically off for a while, so that's a big TBD. So I've never suggested a motion involving myself. Josh, what's the right protocol on this?
I think somebody else could make a motion, I suppose, to nominate people for these positions.
Okay, but then Bill and I can vote for ourselves?
Yeah.
Okay. Does anyone have an alternative slate of candidates they want to put forth? Okay. All right. So does someone want to make a motion to reelect Nick and Bill and Armando to their current board position?
I will make that motion.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay, so now we're moving to item C2. Who's on the phone from Siegel? Is going to go over that with us.
Caitlin, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am on.
Is Jeff?
I think he was going to try. Okay, yeah, he is here.
Okay, great. So on the phone with us is Caitlin Grace and Jeff Williams, our actuaries from Siegel. You've met them several times before, and they are in the process of preparing the 1-1-2023 actuarial evaluation. And as you know, the valuation has just a ton of assumptions in there, both economic and demographic assumptions. And every year the board needs to consider whether any of those assumptions need to be changed or if you want to give any different direction than Siegel has had in the past on those. So Caitlin is going to talk to you about the assumptions that she feels that we need to change from the prior evaluation. So you can take it away, Caitlin.
Sure. Thanks, Kelly. So most of our assumptions were actually set, I guess, back in 2020. We had done, at that point, an experience study for January 1, 2015 through December 31st, 2019. We're not due for another full experience study until 2025, and at that point, we'll look at experience, you know, 2020 through 2024. But we do, from time to time, you know, make recommendations for changes and assumptions in between the experience studies just as stuff changes over the five-year period. So since that last experience study, the assumptions we have tweaked, you know, we lowered the discount rate down to 6.5% with the 2021 valuation. That had resulted in some changes to the ad hoc COLA assumption as well. Also in that 2021 valuation, we updated the amortization methodology based on the new funding policy. And finally, last year, we lowered the administrative expenses just based on some feedback from Kelly and Brenda and their team. So for this year's valuation, we just have two things that we would recommend changing. The first has to do with participants who are active in the drop and their retirement rates. Currently, we assume, obviously, after they're in the drop for 10 years, they stop kind of having that benefit put into the drop balance. Our assumption has kind of always been that they retire at 100% after those 10 years. But as part of kind of some behind the scenes benefit studies we were doing based on some, I guess, requests to improve that benefit, we looked at it and we did, for that study, we had to change that assumption so we could value something, but at the same time, we thought we'd make the recommendation to lower that retirement rate. So after 10 years in the drop, rather than retiring fully at 100%, we lower it to 75%. And that's just based on, you know, what we're seeing in the data. There are a handful of participants who enter the drop but don't retire until well after that 10-year period. So this would just capture the kind of difference between the actual experience and what we're assuming. The other piece that we would recommend changing for 2023 is the salary scale. There are new pay scales that went into effect January 1, 2023, and they included a pretty decent bump in there from the 2022 pay scales, and that's going to result in members kind of having almost a double pay bump as they work up the scale and then also move to the new pay scale. So we would recommend revising the salary scale to reflect those new rates, and so you'd have a slightly higher salary scale rate during 2023 to capture that based on the different rank of the positions, and then slightly higher rates for some participants in 2024 and beyond. So those are the two changes we'd recommend. I'm happy to answer any questions on those. I haven't gone through all the other assumptions, but as Kelly mentioned, we've got all sorts of assumptions that go into the valuation, but our recommendation would only be to change those two at this time, and then ideally, you know, everything else would be reviewed at the next experience study.
The only other change that we talked about, which I think is a good idea, relates to the COLA calculation, and it's not an assumption change, it's more a methodology change. And right now, the way that it works, it's a very time-consuming process where Siegel has to calculate when we meet the criteria, which currently in the bill is we have to be 70% funded after the COLA and have met the return for 3 or 5 years, something like that. And it is way out in the future. It is so far out in the future that number is just not a good number anyway. And it's a long calculation because they have to do it after the fact, and it really slows down the valuation. So the methodology change is that they are going to update that COLA calculation when we do the experience studies and not on an annual basis, which will speed up the valuation process. And right now it's so far, is it 2068 or something?
It's 2073, so 50 years out.
So odds are that isn't the right number anyway, so that's changed.
Two questions. What is the impact of the changes you're recommending? I mean, in terms of either on the funding status, et cetera. And then the second
question is, go ahead. So to your first question, we haven't fully run, especially the salary scale. You know, we're talking about an increase in pay kind of across the board, so that is going to increase the normal cost and cost of future benefit accruals. We haven't run that yet, though, because since we're still in the process of working through the valuation, I guess it's kind of to end because it'll increase your liabilities, obviously, but from a funding basis, you know, it's going to increase the amount of money that participants are paying into the fund because they are contributing a percent of pay basis. The drop retirement rate change we actually did run because that was part of the study. That has a very small impact, but it did actually slightly lower the accrued liability because those participants, they stop, you know, having basically accruing any benefit when they enter the drop. And then after 10 years in the drop, there's nothing being contributed to the drop balance. So it's kind of like they're just sticking around and not getting anything more. So that has a slight decrease in the liability.
Okay. And then my other question was interest rates have gone from 1 to 5% in the last year. Should that impact any of our assumptions?
Well, I guess that would come into the discount, you know, the total discount rate we use to value the liabilities. We are down at 6.5%. You know, we kind of take a look at the capital market assumptions every year. I think what that really says is ideally the likelihood of you hitting that 6.5% is maybe a little more likely than it was a year ago. I think at this time we weren't recommending any change to the total discount rate to kind of see whether that kind of increased interest rate environment continues for a longer period of time.
The other assumption that it changes, that it could impact, is right now we assume that drop accounts are annuitized at 2.75%, which obviously is a little bit low right now, but that's over the life of the plan. So we talked about that and decided to leave it where it is.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other discussion? So there would be a motion to direct Siegel to use the recommended assumptions preparing the January 1st, 2023 actuarial valuation for regular plan and supplemental plan. Someone like to make that motion?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor? That sounds like six ayes. Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay, Kelly, monthly contribution report.
Thank you, Caitlin and Jeff. The contribution report is in your materials at page 19. I have the clicker. This is the April data. That's the June report for the April data. This is in line with the reports that you've seen for the last couple of years. There's no surprises here. They are still 103 people below their hiring plan estimate for the number of employees. Fire was over by 114 people. And police is down to 17. We are seeing an uptick in police retirements right now, but not fire, which I was talking to the benefits staff this morning, and it really just seems like it's the environment because it seems like more people are retiring that are actually uniformed officers versus those that might be not having to wear a uniform every day. So that just might be the world we're living in. Because they seem happy with the chief, happy with his department, happy with things, where things are going, but kind of the environment. There was two pay periods in April. The floor amount and the hiring plan was $11.6 million, and the contributions based on actual comp pay was 12.2%, so the floor didn't add any additional money, which is as we would expect to happen. Are there any questions on the contribution report? Thank you. The next item I'll just roll into is the trustee education and travel. The TechSPERS classes and NCPERS classes are listed here. I don't have anybody that signed up to attend, but if anybody would like to, just let us know and we'll add you to the list.
I have one thought in line with what Bill said. Do we have anything that shows kind of industry-wide or peers of what their discount rates are?
I can get you that. I can get you that for every all the plants in Texas.
Wait, is that something people will be interested in seeing?
I would say the same thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just do you know whether we're...
We're on the lower end. The average has been going down over time. There are a few plants in Texas that are lower than us. PRB publishes a report and I'll turn that to you.
I think we were lower because we had so many liquid assets that we assumed there would be zero return on.
Right.
So that would average us down.
Okay.
Oops. All right. Brendan, you want to talk about the financial audit?
I will. Thank you, Nick.
Please.
Good morning, everyone. The initial field work for the audit is underway. We have completed about 70% of the PBC auditor list and submitted that to the audit team. We are starting to receive back requests for sampling. That is underway as well. All of the confirmations have been sent, and we're receiving those back, with the exception of the legal and the actuary confirmations, which will be done later on towards the end of the audit. Member census data has been sent to BDO so that they can begin that review before the actuary report is completed. The largest outstanding item, as on repeat from prior years, is we're still waiting for some audited financials from our investments. So that will hold us up until we receive those. Preliminary indication is that we would receive them in August or September. They've indicated August, but it's been September for the last 3 years, so we're thinking that's the general time frame.
Are those the two different funds, TUP and Lone Star?
We have Lone Star.
We have Lone Star.
We have Lone Star, but we've done our own valuation on Lone Star the last few years, so there's a portfolio company that's in a sales process, and we're kind of knowing that we have to wait on HUP, we're waiting to see kind of where bids come in there to make sure we're okay with their valuation or if we want to do something different.
So it's really only HUP holding us up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Once we receive those final audited financial statements from the investment, we'll be able to submit information to the actuary to complete the actuary report. And once we submit that information, it should be 45 to 60 days when we will have our audited financials finished.
With HUP, we're not paying them any management fees or any monitoring fees or anything like that. So there's no incentive for them to...
Josh, how do you... Can I answer that?
HUP?
Yeah, he's earning money from the portfolio company and from the debt that he loaned to the portfolio company. So there's no management fees, but there are potential incentives to hold.
Right.
There's no way we can solve that, I guess.
No, I mean, I think if the price is where, I mean, there's probably more incentive to sell than hold, but there's not no money going to the GP.
We can probably go into a little bit on the legal and closed session later.
Okay.
Any questions about the status of the audit?
Okay, Ryan.
Okay, we are way ahead of schedule here, so.
That's fine. We can do the
no pressure. Makita, are you guys on the phone?
Hey, Ryan.
Yes.
Darren. I'm here.
Okay. So Makita's coming down the next 2 weeks after this, so we told him they could take a break and just follow up for this meeting. I'll go through the portfolio update. John, is it? Screen's fucked up. Okay, so on the private markets portfolio, we received no material distributions in May. So as we talked about, we think it'll be a little bit lumpier going forward. We have a planned sale in the AEW portfolio that should come across the summer. Bulk of the $40 million we've received year to date has been from AEW with the Campbell Square property and the J.P. Morgan Maritime Fund. So on the safety reserve drawdown, we initially put it into drawdown in March of 2022. We haven't taken any rebalancing actions in the last month, so I put a summary here of kind of what we've done since that safety reserve has been in drawdown. So over the last year, we've been taking about half of the proceeds that come back and putting them into equity and holding half of them back within the safety reserve. So since March of 22, $84 million has been reinvested into global equity, and $105 million has been held back in the safety reserve, which has extended the coverage amount. We hadn't put anything back within the safety reserve. That portfolio would run out of, you know, benefit payments of $10 million a month in September of 23, and we've extended it to June of 24. On the consultant search, we have interviews a week from today with two groups, Makita and Allborn, for as it relates to the private market consulting services. The idea there would be to have those interviews next week and then bring a recommendation back to the board in July. Any questions on the consultant search? Okay. Okay, year-to-date return on the overall portfolio is 3.7% estimated and 5.3% for the public markets ex cash, which is two-thirds of the portfolio. Covered a few of these just a minute ago on the investment initiatives, but consultant search coming up, or kind of finalizing the decision there. For the June IAC, we're going to talk about the public equity structure and amounts we want in passive versus active manager weights. We plan to issue the RFP to six firms for the Invesco Global Growth replacement and work through that search over the summer. And then I think once we get the consultant decision finalized, we still got a ways to go before we're making new private investments, but some work on, initial pacing, what we want the portfolio to look like, governance, approval process, that type of stuff. So on the equity market drawdown, this is looking at the percent off high of different equity indices since beginning of 22. Orange line is the NASDAQ, so U.S. tech has been on a tear this year. It's up 27% year-to-date, so it's catching back up to the rest of the indices. How we benefit from that is, we have the Walter Scott as a growth manager. We have the ACWI index fund that replaced Invesco for the time being. Our largest holding in the equity portfolio is Microsoft. If we look at where equity markets are now compared to when we put the safety reserve in the drawdown in March of 22. Outside of EM, all the indices, U.S., global, are basically up like 2 to 3%. So it's actually up now compared to when we put it to drawdown. We don't need to make the decision today because we don't have any money to reallocate, but I think at the current market levels, if we have new money coming in, we'd probably favor holding it all back within the safe reserve and rebuilding that back up to target as opposed to putting more money back into the equity portfolio. So this chart, what it's showing here is on the S&P 500, daily returns, and then the bands are around returns that are plus or minus 2%. The title kind of says it all, but the markets have been unusually calm so far this year, especially with all the news around recession fears and bank failures. So obviously 2020 is an outlier year with massive swings day to day, but it's been pretty calm this year. Just looking at the Fed curve, no additional rate hikes are expected, and the market is pricing in drops towards the end of this year and into 2024. So we ended the month at $1.89 billion in AUM. You can see the $47 million of outflows with the $10 million a month there, and then gain and other income of $115 million. Okay, this is looking at our public markets portfolio, the two-thirds of the portfolio in public equity and fixed income. One thing to note here, we're converting over to having this become, right now it's an internally calculated staff report, having Makita work on this and have them be calculating the returns. So I just like that a little bit better from a data integrity and
control
standpoint. So they're working on it kind of behind the scenes, and I think next month or in July or August we'll go live kind of converting over to their return stream.
Sorry, our custodian is the Northern Trust?
Our custodian, JP Morgan.
They don't do this? I mean, they don't calculate returns?
They used to do it, but it would never come in time for the board meeting. So, like in, I don't know, 12 through 16, we would have a JP Morgan flash report, so it would be on a month lag. So it would be the month before. We wanted more real-time data. So, I mean, we're calculating this from the custodian values, but we're just doing it quicker.
Okay.
But I'd rather have a third party kind of calculating it than staff. So, should be no change in kind of what we're showing, but just a different format. Looking at the three-year return, the public portfolio is up 5.7% compared to the benchmark of 4.1. All three of the major asset classes are outperforming the benchmark. And then five of the eight active managers that we've had for the three-year period are outperforming. So good results there. On the asset allocation detail, the only thing to point out here, when I talk about the public equity structure, what we're really talking about is we have right now 8% target weight to the four active global managers. And we think that might be a little bit heavy in terms of concentration. So what we're talking about is dialing that target back down to around 6% and then adding that additional amount to the passive ACWI IMI fund. So we'll go through that with IAC at the end of the month and then bring up the recommendation on how to tweak that back to the board in July.
Hey, Ryan, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
If I recall, the original concept of the safety reserve was a strong suggestion from Makita when we first raised it, and that was How many years ago was that?
That was when they came in. I mean, that was part of their proposal in March of 18.
Okay. So, kind of, I'd be interested in their views then filtered through the IAC on what conditions would need to exist where we would not have a safety reserve anymore. Like, this, a safety reserve is, in a way, temporary status. But when you have a temporary status over multiple years, it feels like it's not temporary anymore. And so I'd be interested in knowing their recommendations filtered through the IAC at what would be the conditions that would need to exist in order for them not to recommend the necessity of a safety reserve anymore.
It would just be like a percentage of funding.
Well, yeah, so let me give my opinion on that, and then I'll see what Kita has to say if they want to add anything now. But so originally it was 15%, which is 30 months.
Yeah.
Now it's 9, which is 18. If you look at our asset allocation compared to peers, we have, I think, no more and maybe less core fixed income than a lot of peer plans. So really, we call it a safe reserve, but it's really just our cash and our investment grade bond allocation. Because it's in the safe reserve, it's probably a shorter duration than peers would have. But it's like, if we didn't have a safe reserve, I don't think we would just take that 6% and put it into equity because we'd have very little in fixed income at that point. So when we talk about the drag on return, I think it's about as minimal as it can be given kind of having a normal-looking asset allocation.
So part of it is a labeling exercise where you have your only at 57% of your short-term investment grade on target, and really part of it is the safety reserve.
Yeah, and I mean, that is the safety reserve. So since we've brought it down, we're at 57% of the target in short-term bonds. If we were fully allocated to the safety reserve, we'd have $171 million versus $128. I don't know. Aaron, Leo, do you have thoughts on this?
Yeah, this is Leo. Two comments. I think it was Nick who brought the topic. By the sound of it. So I would say two variables we're looking at to revisit the need for a safety reserve would be, one, the exiting or distribution of the key legacy private markets positions that are very concentrated in just a handful of holdings. And then number two, my recollection is some of the more of the plan design considerations may be revisited again in 2024. And I think all of those may be aligning to some degree. So I would expect, you know, within the next, you know, 12 to 18 months to re-underwrite the need for a safety reserve, the size, et cetera. Ryan's point was also a good one in the sense that, you know, some of the longer duration core bond exposure has been moved into shorter duration, higher quality to essentially match or offset the known short-term cash outflow. So I think it's worked out very good, and especially now with the current shape of the yield curve, we're actually picking up very good rates for very short duration assets. So I think we can consider that as a tactical move potentially in the future, but for now I would expect the next 12 to 18 months to potentially be a good time to fully revisit these the thesis for it.
What is the yield on the safety reserve now versus, say, the Longfellow account? Are we giving up yield for that? Or
I don't know the number. I mean, our cash portion is in a money market in mid-4s. I think the yield on IRM is right around 5. It's not much of a difference between kind of the yield on IRM and the Longfellow portfolio right now.
Maybe that's something we should look at the IAC meeting.
Does
that make any sense to do? I mean, because those are relatively liquid, the IRM ones. Are we giving up?
And like when we lowered the safety reserve from 15 down to 9, we looked at that. When we originally put the safety reserve in place, we didn't have the 4% core bond allocation, so that's kind of the reserve tank on the safety reserve if we needed to. Right now, it would be bank loans because they're flat and have performed well. Given the duration, I mean, if we got $1 billion of new money in, that would change our cash outflows per year from 6 down to 4. That would, by its nature, kind of affect the amount of safety reserve we would have to have 18 months.
You mean when, not if.
If it's $1 billion or $2 billion, or so. All right, but I mean, we expect to kind of once we get through the consultant decision to revisit asset allocation over the summer, and we'll look at that.
And Ryan, you know that I always love walk down memory lane. When we first started the new board, what was the public market as percent of the total portfolio? I think it's about flipped. It was.
The highest allocation to private markets, which was a little bit before the new board, was in 16 before the secondary sale. It was 2/3 of the portfolio was in private.
Yeah.
When you guys came on, it was probably closer to 50-50. Let me look here real quick.
Yeah. I think it's always important to remember, I mean, when you look at the three-year trailing return, 3 years is a good measurement period, that, 5.7 versus 4.1. And, in equities, it's relatively even to the index. The fact that we have the safety reserve, meaning we're shorter duration, is the reason why we did better on the fixed income side. But this is the portfolio that you perpetuate into the future. I mean, this is the one that actually is the mana for a pension fund like ours. Whereas, before, that was speculation and all sorts of things like that. They just, whether they were good or bad investments, they were inappropriate investments, in my opinion, for a pension fund like this. And so when I really look at what the team has done, and they get, I think, most of the credit, is we've basically, whether it was 2/3 or 50-50, we've monetized out of those what I call inappropriate investments into a more stable long-term thing. And, you always can change ratios quickly by selling things for a dollar. But at the same time, the cash that was generated from that has funded our outflows, which is something I hit Ryan on the head sometimes when I figure out these good facts that he never illustrates, and he should have been illustrating that one, because it really speaks to incredible competence by the team to accomplish that. So I think as we talk about external funding, the way that I characterize it is that when we all came into this, we had, a ship that had malfunctioning, whatever, but it really wasn't capable of moving, and that we have made the ship very functional. And it is a very competent vessel. The only thing it doesn't have now is enough fuel to take everyone to their destinations. And so it's not a question anymore of competence or stewardship. we need to convince people of that, but it's now we just don't have enough fuel in the tanks to complete the voyage for everyone. But we can say to all the interested third parties that we believe is now proven that we're confident and can steward that capital well, very different than how capital was stewarded prior to the railroad. That's kind of the big message that I think and I say, and, you know, a little bit of a segue from what Brian's presentation, but I think it's always important to reflect back where we've come and then where we're going.
So yeah, I had more than one CIO and actuary tell me, and Pat weren't even associated with this, that our previous portfolio was more like an endowment fund than a retirement fund. Is that a fair assessment?
I think it was more like a George Soros speculation.
Yeah, that's
fund.
I think it was more like an endowment fund, but it was much more concentrated than any endowment fund would have been.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So 5 years ago, right now, June of 18, we had 48% of the portfolio in private. Since then, since the new board formation, we've had $880 million in distributions from that portfolio. John, did you get the email I just sent you?
Fantastic.
I just sent you an email. I want to pull up one page to the next point. We can do it quickly. We got time, actually. We're ahead of schedule. So,
you don't have to use it up.
Yeah. The chart that I think we should play out to the portfolio update just to drive home the point is we have a chart that we do as part of the private asset cash flow once a quarter showing 113% of benefit outflow the last 5 years covered from the private markets portfolio, which is very good situation, kind of good outcome from a bad situation that we were in. I think, you know, what's going to happen going forward as we start reinvesting in new private markets, that situation is going to flip. So it's not just the $10 million a month in benefit payments we need to come up with, but it's, you know, new capital commitments and new capital going into the private market portfolio. Okay, don't worry about it. We'll add it next month. So, any other questions on the portfolio before I hand it over to Makita? All right. So,
welcome.
I guess I'll click for you guys if you're on the phone, so just tell me where you want to go with it.
Sounds great, Ryan. This is Aaron. I'll start it off. If you bring us to 44, please.
And this is Aaron.
Let me start.
All green.
I was going to say, before we get here, it's dangerous to tell a consultant or an investment manager that you're ahead of schedule on your agenda, because they'll do their best to get you back slowed down to the actual times. But I'm going to hit, I think, 6 pages on the performance report and probably about 6 on the private markets. All green, as I heard Ryan mention. So usually this is our Christmas-themed executive summary with a little bit of both green and red. But over the trailing 1 year, green up and down the board. And there's two key things, I think, driving this. One was already mentioned, which is the performance of the public active managers. So you see halfway down, 7 of 9 active managers ahead of their benchmarks over this period. And then the other is some of the idiosyncratic lumpy returns of the private portfolio. So you had this year includes the very large write-up of the Huff Energy Fund from the last audit when oil prices jumped significantly. So that's what's driving some of the top line numbers here. Because you can see second and third lines, you know, really significant outperformance versus policy index and versus peers. And that's because that asset is really uncorrelated with anything. Ryan, if you go to 47 next.
Yeah, and for the newer board members and IAC members, the private markets are on a one-quarter lag, so this 1 year includes 2021 year-end write-ups. were marked in the private portfolio. 47.
Yep, this is it. So, and I think this also echoes Nick's point about the you know, the managers that you can control. These are all the public markets managers, and it's another green-red simple scorecard. And you can see there's really no pattern of the no's. You don't see anyone that's underperforming over multiple periods. You know, you're always going to have at least a few spots where one strategy is out of favor over a certain time period. But visually, you see, you know, a lot more outperformance than underperformance. And you also see multiple strategies with some significant NAs over multiple periods. And that's just reflective of the fact that, you know, there's been a lot of change. There's been multiple new strategies added and others removed from the portfolio. Let's jump to 52, please, Ryan. Another chart to visually show what I've explained. So this is the one-year attribution chart. So it shows the sources of outperformance or underperformance relative to your policy benchmark. So anything to the right is good, to the left is bad, and you see that giant green bar for private equity. So that this number or this bar has flip-flopped over the years, depending on, you know, these few strategies and how they report. But over this period, you see it's really what's driven that significant outperformance.
I think if you had to go back prior years, you'd have to have a legal sheet to the left on selection effects.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a picture is worth a thousand words, but if you'll see in a few pages, you know, your long-term private equity numbers are definitely well to the left, you know, relative to benchmarks. But we, you know, we hope that this NAV that was reported that drove this result comes to fruition and they can actually monetize and exit. That's, you know, anything can be on paper, but that's what's more most meaningful for the system. Maybe 57 next. So I'll dive a little deeper into some of the strategies. So we got your global equity portfolio here. And the top one, Walter Scott, just want to highlight some really nice results out of them. If you see in the quarter, up 10%. And the first quarter was another one of those quarters where the growth, you know, the highest growth strategies outperformed, the FANG stocks and anything related to that outperformed. And Walter Scott isn't really an aggressive growth manager. They're more of a quality growth manager. Yet they still produced a nice, strong quarter, outperforming the broad ACWI benchmark. And what they've done is really just not make a lot of mistakes quarter after quarter. And so if you go to the right, you can see, say, the five-year number, you know, a full 3 percentage points net of fees over the index. So that's really helped some of the global equity performance. Let's go two pages forward, and we can talk about the fixed income portfolio a little bit. So earlier there was a conversation about, say, Longfellow and IRM, but I also want to highlight Longfellow versus your bank loan manager, Aristotle Pacific. So first off, Aristotle Pacific, that used to be called Pacific Asset Management. Aristotle and Pacific merged earlier in this year, and the merger seems to be going really well. But let's look at the one-year number. No, I thought Nick may be the king of analogies. I like that, the vessel analogy. But I like to say, you know, each strategy it's like building a team. Each strategy has its position or its role in the portfolio. And bank loans' role is really protection from rising rates. So it had its litmus test over the last year and really 18 months. And you can see if you compare the one-year Aristotle number of basically 3% to Longfellow, which is fixed rate investment grade bonds, you can see did its job. Now, it's really the only part of any pension's public fixed income that produced a positive result over this period. So we're thrilled to see it play its position effectively. And then if you look at the bottom row of it, you see its ranking versus other bank loan managers. So you can see a lower number is better, but they've done a very nice job.
Bill, you had a question on Iron Head versus Longfellow. In April, the yield of the portfolio loan post is 4.94 and Iron Head is 4.92. So it's pretty much the same.
Iron M, if you look at Brian's scorecard earlier, you look at the three-year number, you've actually, Iron M outperformed by about, I think it was 2 or 3 percentage points annualized over that period, just given the real significant negative effect of Longfellow's duration over the last year. So I'll close this section on 63, please. And this was talked about, but now you can see it. So, you know, what has the board done over the past 5 years in terms of shifting the portfolio? And they look at the top one, the blue. So that's your public equity. And that's been a big initiative over the years of increasing that exposure. And you can see it was, you know, just marginally over 20% of the whole system was in the stock market 5 years ago. And so now you see it's you know, grown and grown each year. Got a little pullback in that one point when you had that higher private equity valuation. But you see it's getting closer and closer to that bar chart on the right, which is your policy weight. And conversely, you see real assets on the bottom shrinking.
Yeah, Aaron, I just want to clarify. It's the staff that's done this, not the board. The board has provided broad oversight, but this is really what this team has done. And at least from my standpoint, that's the way I see it. So you guys are the ones that have enabled this thing to happen. It's easy for us to say, you know, yes to a motion. You guys are the ones that actually have to do it. Mm-hmm. So.
This chart... For some clients, it's very boring looking, but this I think will be, the chart in a couple of years to show all the constituents about that will best summarize all the progress that everyone's been making here.
At one point in 16, the public equity allocation was below 10% of the portfolio, so that was kind of the lowest point, and we were selling that off to pick a benefit outflow, and right now it's at 45%. So that's where, you know, the bulk of the money's gone. Come back.
So I'll pause for any questions on the public report. And if there's none, I'll move to the next one.
Aaron, is there anything going on with other clients that you're seeing as trends or soup du jour type stuff that you'd want to flag for us?
Sure. So a few clients that had built out private equity programs all became very overweight after maybe about 6-12 months ago when you had that bad 22 in the public market and a strong private equity market. So you had the denominator effect. So some clients are dealing with similar but different issues as you in terms of, you know, an overweight to private. Outside of that, I would say a philosophical discussion many are having but few are acting on is the fact that the bond market is totally different than it was for the last 5-6 years. So you finally can invest in short-term bonds and get 4 or 5%. So some groups have thought about the de-risking perspective. Do we need to go out and invest so much in the equity market really, it's just discussion. I don't see anybody actually acting on it, but, you know, to use the golf analogy, it's kind of like, you know, it's a short hole, so you can play it different ways now. You could hit an iron off the tee, or you could continue hitting the driver, and most are just kind of sticking with their status quo.
Well, do they have a choice? I mean, these private equities, you get caught in them. And it's not like you can liquidate them very quickly unless the secondary markets have been more active for private.
No. Private. Yeah, very true. On the private side, you know, that's why that's no actions taking place there. But then on the public side of their portfolios, it's more, I think, a function of inertia, just sticking with their plan, and maybe the fact that, you know, the yield curve will not theoretically stay this high for this long on the short end.
I'm seeing a lot of people just headline-wise are shifting, you know, public credit allocations to private credit. There's a lot of money going into that space, so we've kind of had that discussion whether, you know, best time or, you know, everyone thinks it's the best time, and, you know, not a great time.
What about VC, and that is apropos of nothing? Do you see more pensions getting involved in VC on the private side?
I don't know. This is an Aaron question.
We're starting to see some of the biggest negative numbers on the quarter-over-quarter in venture after years and years of just eye-popping positive numbers.
Interesting.
You're talking about returns on cash.
Well, both really. The distributions have slowed, and a lot of the high-flying private venture companies are getting written down a little.
So our venture fund-to-fund industry ventures was down 11% in Q4, and that's probably not nearly enough. Probably more to come.
Do you have a number in your head at what you would actually mark that at?
No, it's their audit number, and they have, you know, numerous underlying fund investments or fund to fund. So I think they're kind of reliant on where the funds they're investing in are marking their funds.
But to your point, a lot of these guys that are private, maybe it's a lot worse than they're actually reporting right now for that reason.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're probably a little bit better off than really a lot of these funds.
I'm hearing 30-40% discounts at least.
I'm hearing something like that.
If you were being cynical, you might think that the valuation of these level three assets are a little bit higher than maybe reality, but that would really be being cynical.
Yeah, I'll add one other asset class insight. I was talking to a real estate manager yesterday, and they were very excited about the buying opportunity in, say, 6 to 12 months in their eyes. So they thought there'd be continued kind of dislocation. This is kind of across real estate broadly. But they were investing a new fund, and they were calling that this to be one of their best vintages in 15 years.
That's kind of like a pre-apology for this year's return.
Yeah. Well, I told him, I said, well, what about all the funds you need to exit?
Which segments were they going to invest in? No, that's just, you got to be careful there.
Yeah.
Office.
Yeah,
you want to do an office. Yeah.
Warehouse. Storage.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, multifamily.
Sorry.
Go ahead, guys.
So I was going to say, I mean, we're probably more than a year away from new real estate, but we talked about the Odyssey, like the core funds, which are open-ended. You know, right now, I think, you know, still the same valuation issue. Hopefully, by the time we're getting back in, those will have fully reset.
So if this is like prediction of another 6 months or a year out where things are going to get cheaper, isn't that like a harbinger for the market? I mean, like, that's predicated on valuations on real estate. Like, if they're going down, I mean, is that a harbinger for more trouble ahead? I'm just saying. I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball, but.
You're talking real estate?
Yeah.
I think that probably the difference between the sub-asset classes will get wider before it converges. So if you're paying rent, they aren't there, and so those areas, residential housing seems to be kind of a mixed bag, still solid. The long-term supply demand is, positive, but there's some short-term indigestion on home affordability. Is at the absolute extreme level that it's ever been. So that's a real negative, but the long-term trends are positive. So I think it's a really mixed bag. It depends where you are. But I do, Ryan's really thinking about all this stuff, knowing that we're still not in an action mode on thinking about where we're going to go.
Sure. I was just making the point that we are kind of like our view is of short term until we get better funding or more fuel.
Yeah.
So that's why we have to focus a little bit more on the short end, just because I think that's what we have to do until then.
Yeah. But just remember that even if 4.5%, which is a very good return, that's below our hurdle rate. So
yeah,
if you're an incremental dollar, if you get 4.5 here, then you're asking another dollar to do 8.5 somewhere else in order to hit your hurdle rate.
Yep.
Okay.
Aaron, what's next?
75, please. Moving to the private market report. So this page and the following two or three are new. Our attempt to do a bit of an executive summary of the private markets report and to highlight changes quarter over quarter. So on the top, you can see private market program as of 9/30 and then as of 12/31 and, quarter over quarter change. So no investments were made, no capital calls were made. You received $55 million in distributions, and the remaining NAV decreased by only 52. So that gain, 55, got back, but the value only went down 52. So a $3 million gain on the quarter, which results in that small positive return on the right. So not a lot of overall activity, but $55 million in the pocket. The big distributions are listed on the bottom there. Ryan's highlighted those at prior meetings. So Ryan, if you could just flip through these first couple pages, so 76 next. So we do the same for each asset class. So if you want to just look at the bottom row of each, the change number, private equity basically unchanged, but you got $13 million in distributions. Real estate, AEW, so you got $29 million back, but the valuation only decreased by 18, so nice, that results in a 5% quarterly return there. Go to the next page, please. Infrastructure, again, some solid distributions, $13 million back, but price or the valuation decreased by $16 million, so that's a quarterly loss. No real change on your ag portfolio with Hancock, and then 78. Timber, no distributions and a valuation decrease, so that's a big minus 20 when you do the math. All that together,
The valuation decrease there was just the South African portfolio. They're writing that down to the expected sales price.
So all that together resulted in basically that zero return on the quarter. But, $55 million back in distributions. Let's go to 80, please. So this is what you currently own in terms of valuation. So the target weights to private equity, private real estate, and ag are 5% each. And so if for round numbers, think of the total DPSP as about $2 billion. That means we're targeting $100 million to each one of those pieces of the pie chart. So if you look at ag, $92 million, you're pretty much on target there. Private equity, you want $100 million, you have $243 million in exposure. So significantly still overweight there. And then on real estate, about double the weight. Think about the purple and the green. Those are, the goal is to just liquidate those down to zero. If you're looking at the pink, so $243 million private equity, $173 of that is one investment, you know, the Huff Energy. So that's the multiple people's comments earlier. That's a very binary asset in terms of what the outcome is there. And the orange on the real estate, it's kind of the same way with AEW, although AEW is a compilation of assets, but they are the lion's share of that 190 as well. So, you know, the future will really be dictated on the exits that come out of those few assets. I'll leave it there. The next page has the multiples, if you want to see them, but the story is pretty much the same every quarter. If you look at the green, that shows your multiple for dollar in versus where you're at in terms of combined distributions and remaining value. And ag has been successful, but everything else, even if you get every penny back that's on paper now, you're basically breaking even. You see the greens are all covering around the one, with the exception of timber.
And I mean, the one thing I would add to this chart is this is only what we currently still own. So like in infrastructure, we had the toll road exits that were very good. They, once we sold them, they drop out of these bars. So
what's left in infrastructure now?
There's the two Asian infrastructure funds that were originally JP Morgan that is the Roshan Group now. There's one co-owned asset between Fund 1 and Fund 2, and then the JP Morgan Maritime Fund, which is, we've gotten a lot of distributions back, and we expect that to kind of wind up this year.
That's good.
So this chart on 81 really is the industry issue. If you look at the ratio or the DPI to TVPI across all peers, what you're seeing is you might have presentations or people sitting in board meetings like this where they're showing TVPIs that might be, you know, 2, 2.5, 3, 1, whatever, but the DPI might be like 20% of that number or 40% of that number, which you say if you're early in investing, then that might make sense. But if you have a mature portfolio, what it means is that unrealized marks are this higher number, but realized results are much lower. And just, you know, what I'm seeing in the marketplace is that everyone's saying, like, I'd want to name a rate source 6 to 12 months from now, because you're hearing that same phrase over and over and over again. And what it means to me is that sellers and buyers just have a wide bid-ask spread, that you might have a private equity owner that values a company at 8 times, which might be an appropriate mark for 2 or 3 years ago, but the real market clearing price today is 6 times. And that, so there's no one's doing anything because there's this wide bid-ask spread. But what will happen is that these companies have debt on them and whatever, and events will cause there to be market clearing events. We're just in that period where no one's willing to budge. And market forces will cause people to budge, and then hence that might be a good time for us to come back in, and we'll see. So,
yeah. Hmm. Makes sense.
Brian, or
Aaron, that's it for the private market, right?
That's it. So, happy to field any questions, and if not, we're look forward to seeing a few of you next week and a few others the following.
Yeah, Aaron, I would be interested as we roll forward you to give us updates on this issue of peers with illiquid assets, and are they having the sell in the secondary market and all that kind of stuff. I think it would be very helpful information that you would have visibility to that we would
Yep, happy to. Anecdotally, one client I work with, they did sell like $130 million on the secondary market last year, and they got price around the high 70s in terms of percentage of NAV. That was pressure from you know, the governing body of their city, because they were so far over their private equity range. But happy to kind of continue to provide other experiences from clients as we see them.
Did you say they sold their excess assets at 70 cents of NAV?
Yeah. 71
cents.
Yeah, I think it was like 78% or something like that. Healthy assets.
Quality assets.
Yeah.
What about an outlier on the upside? Have you seen any standouts other than us? But I mean, it's just like
an outlier. In terms of general returns, total level?
Yeah.
You know, some of our clients for years implemented what we called the risk mitigating strategy bucket, which was CTAs and long vol, and basically, you know, they benefited from the significant sell-off in 2022. So they had, you know, strong results. But really, those are the only kind of portfolios I've seen that have had real positive outliers.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right, Josh? Yes.
So the session ended. Of course, there's a special session and probably more special sessions to come on other topics unrelated to pensions. Our bill did pass the House and the Senate, HB 4034. The rule is that if the bill is, the governor has 10 days in which to veto or sign, otherwise it becomes law, except in the case where the bill is passed in the last 10 days of the session, at which point the governor has 20 days to sign or veto, otherwise it becomes law. So my calculation, I think the session ended May 30th, so I think the calculation is on June 19th that the bill would become law if the governor doesn't veto it. I don't think there's any indication that he would veto it. He may not sign it because most of the bills get passed in the last week or 10 days or something of the session. So our expectation is that the bill will become law, and we are already discussing how to implement that. It would be effective September 1st. Future deaths would be covered, as well as increasing the benefit for the current survivors of people who had been deemed to have died in the line of duty. So
that's prospectively, right?
Prospectively.
If it changes prospectively.
Correct.
Is there anything else in the bill that would be viewed as controversial that could kill it? Or?
No, I think it's
fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. That's good.
Yeah.
Good work.
The other two items of note in the session that we discussed previously, the drop bill, which would increase from 10 to 20 years the amount of time people could stay in drop, that did not ultimately get a hearing in the Senate and did not get through. Got through the House, but didn't get through the Senate, and so that did not make it. Likely, its proponents will try to push it in 2025, but of course, as we all know, 2025 is going to be a big overhaul, likely, of our statute anyway, so whether that gets in or not, nobody really knows. The other important item to note is that the investment-related bill that got through the Senate, SB 1446, did not get through the House. It's not clear if there was not as much support in the House, and it kind of died as the House was taking a rush of business. The House didn't get to it. I think probably every pension system in Texas is used that as a positive sign, putting the politics aside, I think just it was going to cost more money, it was going to cost take more time, and potentially cost pension systems in investment returns. So I think everybody viewed that as something that's good. I have no doubt it will likely come back around in 2025, and it will be dealt with at that point. But
yeah, plus the lieutenant governor in the special session also wanted to push 1446. However, the lieutenant governor is no jurisdiction, I guess, for lack of a better term. Only the governor had set the special session, but Patrick wanted it in there.
Right. I think that's, I mean, my guess is that's probably politics, and that's fine. You know, that's all. That's what's done in Austin. That's great. But from our perspective, I think we're all, this is, you know, this is helpful to not have to put in, you know, additional procedures in for that. So that's really it for this legislative session in terms of the pension-related items.
Want to go to the overpayment item since we're going to do that in open session?
Okay, and then the natural resources, what's next?
Right, that'll be, they're not here yet?
No.
Okay, they're not here yet. Plus, that'll be mostly in closed session.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so if we could switch down to item number 10. Melissa, will you hand out this page? We previewed this item for you last month, but we weren't ready to talk about it yet last month. So we are required by the IRS as well as the Texas government code to collect overpayments that we make to members. Even when that's a mistake on our part, the member would have had no way of knowing that. We're required by law to do that. And the board has adopted a policy to comply that is in alignment with the IRS rules on how to collect and when we must assess interest amount. So the board does have a policy. In the board's policy, it is required that I come to you and let you know anytime we have an error that is more than $10,000. When we have other overpayments or underpayments under $10,000, I can correct those on my own and don't need to bring it to the board as long as I'm within the policy. So as we talked last time, we have this situation where we have a number of members that in two different pay periods, one in late 1990 and one in January 15th, 1991, it appears the contribution file most likely started to be uploaded and there was a problem. It stopped and got re-uploaded again. So they have duplicate contributions for one pay period 30-some years ago. And for a group of people, if those two pay periods, one or the other, or both of those pay periods fell within their highest 60 months that were used to calculate their benefit, that resulted in an overpayment of their contributions if it wasn't caught. Some of them were caught. It was actually a couple hundred people, I think. 200, 400 people, how many, John?
Yeah.
A lot of people, many of those people, they were either corrected or they have since passed away, so they're no longer on this list. John and Brenda, by the way, did an incredible job sorting through this because, as you can imagine, it's a 30-year-old issue. Very complicated. So they weeded through this, and we're down to basically these 11 members, nine of which we need to try to collect the money from. All of these people have been retired for a long time because obviously those 60 months had to be within their time frame. So they're between the ages of 75 and 81. And I'll kind of talk to you about this spreadsheet. I have it also here for the people that are on the phone. It's broken into two parts, but we have handouts here. So what this, the way to read this spreadsheet is we have the first column is the member or it's just so we could track them. And so you'll see member one, spouse one. That is one family. So this member number one has passed away. So their spouse is now getting the benefit. And we have member two, spouse two, same situation, the member's passed away. Member three is a disabled member who got a divorce. So we're paying both, currently paying both the disabled member and their former spouse. And then the other people on the list are all retirees that are being paid. above the horizontal line in the middle of the chart, those people did not have a drop account or do not currently have a drop annuity that I can take the money from. One of them did have a drop account, but they took all their money during the run on the bank period, so there's no drop annuity to take it from. The four people at the bottom of the list are currently receiving a drop annuity. So the way to read this is the first three columns after the status, those are their regular monthly benefit payments. So the cumulative overpayment for these people from the beginning of time until now is that third column over. So member number one, who was deceased, was overpaid. These are small dollars, but we're still required to do it. So that person was overpaid $3,035.73 with their regular benefit payment. We can't collect that back because that person is deceased. But in the second column over, we are also prohibited to collect anything that's over 3 years old. So the third column is the total overpayment, and then that middle column under regular benefit is what is eligible to be collected. The next column over is how we would adjust our benefit going forward, because we need to correct it and lower it to take into consideration what it should have been. So that's the adjustment there. Same thing for the next three columns, but this is drop. So the total that drop was overpaid, how much we can collect over that was paid in the last 3 years, and then the estimated reduction in their drop balance. I've added these last two columns, which just to tell you how big or small their payments are, so you would know, for example, this spouse number one, which is the second line, their overpayment on their regular plan was $217.62. Their current monthly benefit is $792. So if I took that from, in one lump sum from their current balance, that would be 27% of their current pay, which is a big reduction. So based on these numbers, I've made, first before I talk to you about my recommendation, are there any questions about that, any of this so far?
What's the 10? You mentioned 10,000. We're required if it's more than 10,000.
I'm required to tell the board. I'm required if it's over $100 to try to collect it.
Oh, okay. That's
so if we do that. If there's a problem, then I just come over.
The cost of doing this is probably well in excess of that.
Oh, the cost of this is well. I know Brenda alone spent more than 20 hours on one.
Yeah,
it's not in the law.
Is there not a just waive it?
Right, we can't.
So, the one you just mentioned, I guess he's getting paid $792. What are the alternatives? Can you take a little bit versus the 20% of their?
Yes. So my recommendation for people above the horizontal line is, really for everybody to, starting in end of July, to adjust their payments going forward. And then to recover the amount for the people that do not have a drop annuity, I would give them a choice. And the choice would be to pay it, to have us reduce their monthly benefit either over 6 months or 12 months. And if I did it over 6 months, it's a 5% reduction for most people. But I do it over 12 months, it's a 2.5% reduction. The problem with the 12 months is I'm required to charge them interest going back to when the overpayment was made. That's a required, I know. And it's no fault of theirs. They would have had no way of knowing this, but that's required in the IRS rules. So we have to assess interest if it goes over the fiscal year.
So could you make it 11 months?
That's what I was just going to say.
It's fiscal year, not calendar year.
Okay.
So if this would have happened in January, I could have done 12 months without having to charge interest. Doesn't make sense, but
so let me get this straight. This is only you can only collect for the last 3 years.
Yes.
Okay.
So only I collect the last 3 years. So for example, that family, member number one of spouse number one, together they were overpaid approximately $3,300 as a family. We can collect $217 of that. Whereas if you look at member number four, that person was overpaid, almost $18,000 between the drop and their regular plan, and I can collect $1,100 of it. So my recommendation is to give people without a drop account a choice of 6 months or 12 months with interest. If you do have a drop account, my recommendation is to give the person a choice of let's take both the drop over payment and the benefit payment out of their current drop annuity and re-annuitize that so we collect it all immediately, or have it reduced in 6 months and not give them the 12-month option. So those are my two.
You're going to have to spell out the 12-month includes interest.
We're going to have to walk these numbers.
You're almost better off not giving them that option, are you?
Yeah.
It's going to be extraordinarily expensive to go back and charge interest for 30 years.
Well, we only go back 36 months.
36 months, 3 years.
At the plan, assumed rate of return. So, and the only, honestly, the only one that I'm really concerned about is the spouse number one.
$3,000.
Because the other one, you know, taking 5% off some of these other benefits might.
Spouse number one, you're only going to take back $217, right?
Right, but their benefit's only $792. They have a very small benefit.
Yeah, but if you do it over 6 months, it's
right. I mean, it's up to the board if you want me to. I guess if we could talk to them and if they have a pushback.
Yeah.
Because that is significant.
Yeah.
For a monthly, I mean.
Well, it's hard given the fact with inflation and they haven't had COLAs. And,
exactly.
You know, it's going to be hard to explain this anyway to these people.
Whose job is that?
That's the counselor's job.
I mean, my view is it should be easy. Make this as easy as possible on anybody that's on this list.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think it's crazy that we got to spend all this money to even do this. It's costing
us more.
I think
Brendan and John would agree with that.
Yeah. But if you have to do it, try to make it as less painful as possible.
What is the interest if it goes over a year?
Yeah.
We have to assess interest at our assumed rate of return. So it would be 6.5% now, and then when we lowered it from where we're at 7 or 7.25, we would have to do it.
So it's almost better just to do the 6 months and save them from themselves if they take the interest.
But you got to make that optionality too, though. I agree.
How about would the board be okay if we presented the 6 month option, and then if that is going to create a severe financial hardship, then I have the flexibility to extend it longer.
Yeah, I think that's good. Yeah.
I put this in the category of. You know, that we have to provide the view that we're functioning appropriately with the laws but we're loaded to do this at a human level.
Yeah.
But we have to be able to present as we look to money going forward that we adhere to the rules that we're governed by.
And the other part of it, too, on an equitable part, you could say this has been going on for a lot longer, but by law we only are collecting now. Because I think you see the totality of the mistake and just what you're kind of resolving.
That will be the message. So the message to the member would be you were overpaid by, X number of dollars, and we need to recover a smaller number. Still not quite good.
Yes, I agree.
It will be very confusing.
And
okay, so so with the adjustments that Kelly verbalized, do we have a motion to approve this proposed plan to recover the payments? Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion carries.
Very well done, by the way, for complicated issue. for its numbers, too.
Okay. All right.
Kelly, what's the summation total dollars on that would be paid back for that?
The total dollars will be between the two about $16,000.
$16?
Yeah,
$16. Oh, geez. Okay.
Right.
All right, we're ready to move into the ag portfolio. Okay, so we're pleased to have Stu and Mitchell here today from Manulife Agricultural Management. They've been Hancock. I've had to call them Hancock for 2 years after the merger, so it's a little bit confusing because we have Manulife that manages a global equity portfolio, but I'm trying my best to call them by the correct name now. So they've managed a ag portfolio, direct ag portfolio for DPFP since the last 25 years. Right now we have $93 million in the portfolio, which makes up the bulk of our natural resources allocation. We talked about earlier in terms of long-term private allocation, this is the 5% natural resources that we plan to keep this portfolio, at least in its current form, for, you know, the medium term. We might make some tweaks to it as we go. Very strong returns on this portfolio since inception. I think this portfolio was up to about $180 million-ish at some point in 16, and as we were selling off kind of some other private market assets, we worked with them closely to come up with a wholesale plan, and we sold 16 properties and got $71 million back in proceeds over the last, I guess it was mainly 16 to 20 probably time frame. So the current portfolio, we have a fairly concentrated portfolio in direct permanent crops, seven in California and one in Washington. And then Stu and Mitchell will get into it more, but we have a couple properties that have water issues, and we're looking at kind of near-term options on those. So with that, over to you, Stu.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for having us. Good to be back. This year is significantly less hot than last year when we were here, so that's very well appreciated. We'll start by just kind of giving, as Ryan already did, a great introduction, but give you guys a high-level understanding of what Manulife Investment Management is and where we sit in the kind of world of natural capital management, which is the new term for natural resources. So we are the world's largest natural capital manager, which is ag and timber, with almost $15 billion under management internationally. On the ag side, we have just over $4 billion under management, split between four countries, U.S., Canada, Australia, and Chile. These produce are mainly focused on permanent crops as well as a large row crop investment and increasingly a plus investment, what we call investing up the value chain, so linking land assets to processing, logistics, and further value-added strategies as well. We have a strong, since inception, IRR. Dallas Police and Fire Pension have been one of our longest-standing clients, so a great relationship, and really proves out the benefit of a long-standing portfolio as this specific portfolio exceeds returns of our total fund portfolio. So a fantastic return for the pension fund here. We're split, as I said, between four different countries, but obviously 80% of the AUM is here in the U.S., and of that, about 60% is focused in California, so also mimics a lot of the concentration we see in this portfolio today. What I want to do is...
Those returns just us, or is that for this...
That's for our full platform, yeah. So we'll go into more specific returns in the closed session. What I would like to give it now is a general kind of agricultural update and to kind of talk about and contrast where we were last year and where we were now, because it's been a very a year full of change, specifically for this portfolio. So last year when we talked about where we were ag-wise, inflation was the big name, and the specifically inflation of inputs. So fertilizer prices were up some in some products over 60%. Fuel was up exceptionally high. All sorts of input products were really causing a lot of stress for farmers across the nation. We're now seeing all those price increases peel back, still moving up for most of them, but we're seeing actually fertilizer and fuel specifically reduce in price, which is a huge relief for farmers and ourselves as well. And just to remind you, we directly farm all the assets in this portfolio, so we are the farmers. As well, the debt portfolio of the American farmer continues to improve, which is a little counterintuitive considering the increasing interest rate we see across the board. But farmers have taken a very conservative approach to debt since the crisis in the 1980s and have been able to manage this recent increase in inflation or in rates very smoothly. And so we're seeing farmers across the board flush with cash off high commodity prices from last year, specifically on the row crops, not so much on the permanent crops, but we'll get into that, and solid balance sheets, so strong debt profile. So we're seeing continued high value in land prices and difficult deploying new capital based on that scenario, but positive for existing assets, which is a portfolio such as this. Another big kind of change from where we were last year is we were still coming out of the pandemic supply logistics issues. So we had stockpiles of commodities across the U.S. that we couldn't get to market. On tree nuts in California, we had stockpiles of almonds and pistachios waiting for containers to be shipped overseas. Some of the highest stock ratio, stock-to-use ratios we'd seen in the past, that's really significantly cleared out over the last 12 months, which is really important to see that product move. Tree nuts, unlike a lot of other agricultural products, have a long storage life. So you can store an almond after harvest for up to 2 years, which creates a significantly different commodity market dynamic than, say, an apple, which will last a year, or, say, wheat, which will last 6 to 8 months. So having those inventories move out in preparation for this year's harvest is really important for price, because that was the main theme last year too. Nut prices were down and almond prices were very, very weak. And we've now seen that bottoming occur, and we're starting to see prices creep back up as we see demand, better logistics and movement, and exports specifically into China. So we're seeing the Chinese U.S. relationship improve in terms of trade, which is really driving a lot of that year-over-year increase. You'll see over the last 3 years since 2020, we've seen a 15-year percent increase in export of ag goods out of the U.S. So that's very great. Moving more specifically on to the tree nuts that we're exposed to in this portfolio, almonds and pistachios, is obviously a huge play on the water scenario in California. And we will get into the details of how that's significantly changed over the last 12 months. But the long-term picture still remains a large concern. And so the overplanting of almond acres in California still remains an issue. And with the uncertainty of water regulation, the question is how many of those acres are going to come out, and what will that impact be for those who remain as growers, and what will that impact be for price? And so there's still a large amount of uncertainty, but what we see is if you can be a survivor as a grower, there's advantages on the other side of that regulation kind of coming to fruition. So our economic research team is looking at a net acreage removal of around 180,000 acres, which is about 13% of the total bearing acres currently in the ground right now, which is quite a significant amount of production. So if we can manage to navigate this change in the market, there'll be benefits for us on the other side. With that, I'm going to hand it over to Mitchell, who's going to walk us through a little bit of the history of the account itself, just to get you up to date and give you a refresher.
That's one question, Art. Is demand for almonds just growing? I mean, just with the almond milk and all that kind of stuff?
It is. It remains one of the better growth profiles of a annual CAGR of over 2% for the last almost 10 years. Big peak growth was in the early 2010s when we saw huge marketing campaigns by the Consortium of Almond Growers, specifically Blue Diamond. You might be familiar with the label. Is a co-op based processor. A lot of efforts to expand the product base, so not just snacking almonds, but as you said, almond milk, almond butter, almonds and different ingredients, from candy bars to all these different snack items, and almond flour is actually becoming quite popular. We are seeing that it's been a very difficult period to measure demand growth with the logistics challenges we've had over the last 2 years. So are we still seeing that over 2% annual growth in consumption of almonds? We'll need another 18 months to really determine exactly what the market is consuming. But we're now seeing those almonds get to market, and that's very positive. So we're still seeing lots of growth in tree nuts across the board. We specifically are looking more at pistachios these days, which is 53% of this portfolio. And we're seeing pistachios because it's now doing what almonds did 10 years ago, where it's diversifying its ingredient base. It's got a large amount of push behind it. Not a huge co-op, but a huge company based out of California, the wonderful company. Processes about 50% of California almonds, and you can see now just on product shelves they've got shell-less pistachios available.
We buy them with the different honey, the chili,
hot chili, all these sorts.
They're really good, and they're pricey too.
Yeah, they are.
they're very expensive, and that margin
filters down to the grower,
yeah.
Specifically more than almonds. Now, the challenges, and I don't want to divert the conversation too much, but the challenges with those almond acres coming out of California, the concern is if more pistachio acres go in. The pistachio tree is considered a much more hardy tree, and they're able to weather more drought conditions and extreme weather conditions. So as farmers are saying, okay, I don't have enough water and I don't have enough resources to continue to farm almonds, I'll switch to pistachios. Some trade-off there is you can put an almond tree in the ground and you'll have a full commercial bearing harvest in 4 years, where that takes 7 years in pistachios. So you've got a longer.
So we're going to be seeing pistachio milk.
I eat pistachio ice cream, so
yeah.
Maybe I'll leave it. I'll stop there, but. It's a good question. We'll see. I mean, it's fascinating what they're coming up with.
Yeah.
Particularly, I was literally just touring a processing plant the day before yesterday of almonds, and the value-added products that they're coming up with is incredible. And the amount of R&D going into it, where they're trying to really find new markets, is really important for us as growers. We'll give a bit of a refresher on the account, and I mean, Ryan already walked us through the history, so we'll move through this quickly. And
can you do one thing just real quickly?
Yeah.
Can you just explain? So if I'm there in California in one of these counties, and whether it's pistachio or almonds, and you say like you're saying that you're the farmer, okay? Walk us through. So if I were to go to the say who's the boss here, and you know, the guy who's head of operations for that, would he say he works for Manulife, or do you contract with, you know, someone? I mean, walk us through just that. We understand how equities and fixed income work, but walk us through the chain of
that is
farming to
yeah.
our ownership, so we understand that in context when you explain what you do.
That's a great question. I wonder, though, should we go through that detail in the closed session?
That's fine. Whatever, just at some point.
Okay.
I'd like to walk away today with a better
Perfect.
Understanding.
And I can give you the full picture of the platform
okay.
versus the portfolio.
Okay.
Yeah, that's great. So we'll quickly cover these slides
yes.
and move to the closed session.
Yes, we'll touch on this really briefly, as Ryan already talked about. But you know, account established in 1998. Since then, it's gone through a bit of a change. You can see the peak in, say, 2015 to 2018. That's when we sold off all the row crops. The money back to Dallas Police and Fire. And since then, we're sitting on a permanent crop portfolio. Looking specifically at the portfolio, as of the end of Q1, we have $85 million in market value with 8 properties across 2 regions. In the 8 properties, we have 4 almond properties and then 3 pistachio properties. As well as an apple property located in Washington State. Since inception, 2.07 DPI, 3.21 TDPI, and then an 11.52% inception IRR.
Now we will move to